You have just tuned in to the Child Welfare Leaders Podcast. I'm your host, Cherish Fields, master level social worker and child welfare leader. Here at the Child Welfare Leaders Podcast, we are challenging the status quo with authentic conversations about what you can do that will challenge the way you think, provide you with the knowledge to improve practice, spark the inspiration needed to lead against the status quo, and empower you to grow against the grain, all while breaking the barriers in your way that will set a new standard of leading the change you desire to see in child welfare. Now, join me as we start the conversation. All right, guys, I am back. Your host, Cherish Fields, with the Child Welfare Leaders Podcast. You have a treat today because I am so pleased to be able to invite Carrie Richmond to the podcast. She is a former alumni of foster care, and she is making her way in the world as an advocate and a voice just with foster youth and overall just helping people understand the impact of foster care and how that ultimately we all are resilient individuals despite what we have come through. So it's such a pleasure to invite Carrie. Carrie, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to let you introduce yourself to the world and all that you're doing. And then we can get started.
All right. Well, hello, everyone. My name is Carrie Hope, and I'm originally from the Midwest. I grew up in Ohio and Indiana, but now I live in Washington, D.C., where I love getting out, enjoying live music, trying new exercise classes. I love traveling. And in my day-to-day, I work at the American Academy of Pediatrics, managing our child welfare policy portfolio. And when I'm not doing that, I run the nonprofit Unbelievably Resilient, which is comprised completely of individuals who were once in foster care, who are on a mission to change the narrative in the foster care system. And we do that by sharing our own journeys, moving from trauma to triumph. I'm really excited to be here with you.
Awesome. I love it. You know what? That I met Carrie when in my work that I did with House of Providence, and it was such a pleasure to meet her and just to get to know her just a little bit. And it was just awesome. And like, you know what? I need her on the podcast. I need to hear her story. And then it was funny. So just to kind of give you guys a little bit, I was actually looking at podcasts that I wanted to participate in, and I came across the, it was formerly called
Foster Strong.
And it was funny because I reached out and was like, hey, I'd like to be in the producer at the time. Candy was like, oh, I need somebody. Yeah. Can you come on? And I was like, yeah, awesome. This worked out. And then come to find out Carrie's behind it. I didn't even realize. So it's awesome how things just work together, you know, divine connections. But listen, it's a treat because today we're going to talk about something that's really near to my heart because it's been an experience that I've had personally. And Carrie's going to join me in kind of talking a little bit about this because we want to just share a message with all those that are listening to the Child Welfare Leaders Podcast and how to really reach kids, but also as they age, what do we need to do? How do we need to think about them in their growth and maturity and their development, and how to continue to support their successes? And that's really what the message that we want you to get today. And so hopefully you'll get that from the conversation that Carrie and I have. So without further ado, we're titling this episode More Than a Foster Kid. So to jump us off, Carrie, you know, I have a question. If you wouldn't mind, could you tell us a little bit about nothing in depth, but just like your foster story, like how you got through it. And then we're going to get into your adulthood and after life after foster care.
Yeah. So for me, my story started when I was born. I went straight into the foster care system. My parents had already been deemed unfit. My mom struggled with mental health diagnoses, and my father wasn't really in the picture, had his own addiction that he was working through. And so was in foster care for 2 years, and then my father was cleared and we were reunified. So I went to live with him for a few years, and unfortunately it was not a healthy situation, and he was still struggling to overcome alcohol abuse, and there's some other abuse happening in the home. So I went back into the foster care system. When I went back into the system, it was not too long before I was matched with a family who wanted to adopt me. And it was a large family. I was the youngest of six. And within a few years, that adoptive family imploded. So my adoptive parents got divorced. There was drug addiction. There was other abuse happening. And so the best way that I really describe my foster care experience is that I've seen every failure of the system. I've seen failure to provide preventative services that keep families together. I've seen failed reunification. I've seen failed adoption. So my adoption was never formally dissolved. We ended up moving away. My mom took my sister and I, went to a new state. She tried to start over, and it was really hard for her. She was a single mom, had never been on her own in 25 years. And she quickly became, used alcohol as a coping mechanism and became pretty tapped out of parenting. So by the time I was in high school, I was pretty independent. I worked two jobs. I paid for most of my things myself. I was never at home. I was, always with friends. And I say that my village truly did raise me. And if it weren't for them, I wouldn't be who I am today. And finally, when I got into my senior year, things at home were chaotic enough that my friend's parents started to recognize. And my best friend's family ended up taking me in, navigating me getting to college, and are really my unit, who I would consider family to this day. So that's the newborn through age 18 years.
Okay. How did you make it through those times? So like, what do you feel like were the pinnacle points that helped you to not give up ultimately, to say, well, this is it for me?
I would say one for sure is faith. I had believed in God and had a relationship with my faith from the time I was a very little girl. And I always did feel that he had his hand on my life. And I always had this sense of hope that things were going to get better. And that if I could just keep putting one foot in front of the other, that there was light at the end of the tunnel. And I think that came from when I was first accepting, Jesus into my heart as a 5-year-old. I hated thunderstorms. They scared the crap out of me. I would cry. Like it was horrible. And the night that I prayed to accept Christ into my heart, I had a dream that I was sleeping on a cloud and it was raining and it started thunderstorming. And this hand scooped me up from that cloud and brought me to a cloud that had this huge rainbow umbrella underneath it. And I was dry and I went back to sleep and it was a peaceful sleep. And that was it. That was the dream. I woke up the next morning. I told my adoptive mom about the dream. And I love that she did this because it seared it into my mind. She did this craft where basically I drew the umbrella rainbow and we put a popsicle stick on it and we hung it on the fridge. And as we did this, she told me rainbows are a sign of hope. They're a sign that, after the storm, there's a promise of something better. And that really resonated with my little 5-year-old Carrie. And I think it sunk into my spirit and that there was always something coming after the storm that I could look forward to. And then I had amazing, amazing community members, teachers who championed for me, who encouraged me and affirmed me, who really spoke life into me, that I was smart and I had so much potential and that I was gonna go so far one day. And I had amazing coaches and playing little league sports. And then I had amazing friends and their parents just loved on me. And so I got those, what I was missing at home, I got through the community enough to fill me up and get me through some of those chaotic times.
That's really key. I think that that's really what shapes us, right? So even in the hardest times, it's not about what we lack, but what can we get and what how can we build a sense of community around someone going through something like foster care to help them not feel the deficit so much, right? And
Absolutely.
it sounds like that's what you were able to get, along with the fact that you had a foundation that was rooted in faith, of course, and what Jesus can provide. And I think that's amazing myself too. So I can totally relate to the fact the one thing that my adoptive mom did that I felt like was something that really mattered later in life was that she introduced me to who Jesus was. And so I always knew that there was something, that was watching over me, right? And I just didn't get to really know or build relationship, but I leaned on my faith when I was homeless or I didn't have anything. Like that was my best friend. That's who I communed with. That's who I talked to about every single thing and was authentically myself. And I think that's what built me up a lot in being able to endure, if you will. So that's amazing. I'm listening to you and I'm saying, oh, that's a factor, right? That's a major piece. Community and faith, right?
I do. I think when we talk to young people who are success stories, and I'm using quotes, success stories, because we define that so many different ways and sometimes in the wrong ways. If you listen closely to what was it that helped them get through these turbulent times, a lot of them will point to either one person. Like, it was my basketball coach, it was my kindergarten teacher, whatever. Or they'll say faith. And I think those are really two underlying factors of resilience.
Absolutely. I would agree. I think it's one of the key foundations that are built. And I think those things, even further as you go through, then you'll have other people that kind of come in and it just almost like waters what is there, right? I love that. Talk to us about what inspired you to, so you hit 18, you endured because you had faith, and then you had this community of people that despite what you were going through and how challenging it was, you still had a sense of what you said, hope, which is like that key word. And what you go by. I love it. It's your name, your name. And so can you tell us when you hit 18, 18 is pivotal in our society for foster kids because you quote unquote age out the system. Almost as your release date. I always say sometimes too, it's almost like a prisoner, like, hey, here's your expected release date. You get to go out into the world when you really don't even have a clue as to what the world really looks like, right? And how to utilize what's in the world properly to help you as a person develop and grow and so on and so forth. So a lot of times what we see with our population that age out is the tools are very minimal. The equipment, if you will, what we have done to equip kids and our youth have been very sporadic and broken and not succinct. And so they get pieces that they have to figure out versus having someone really walk with them like a parent. Like you would have a staple. Normally, if you're not in foster care, you would have someone in your family, grandma, auntie, mom, dad, mom and dad, whoever, auntie, a cousin, somebody there who have been a part of your life consistently to kind of help and be that go-to person. In foster care, that is not the case. So as we know, if you're listening, and you're in child welfare, you just enter child welfare, or if you haven't worked with youth, that age out. These are some of the challenges that we're looking for solutions for. Everybody is trying to find what can we do to help our older youth, because that group of individuals are at risk in our society of all these negative things, and falling into these pitfalls of society, which include going to prison, unemployment, being homeless, being a parent early, which can add to the challenge. It's not a bad thing, but it can be more challenging when there's other odds against that youth. So ultimately, the solution has been send them to college.
Mm-hmm.
Send them to college. Just mm-hmm. funnel them there, you know. Then they have housing, there's funds, right? There's people, and there's education. So that has been a solution that has been offered. Other have been life skills, right? Going to classes, and being able to get a check as a reward, I guess, for going to the class. So those have been some answers, I guess, if you will. And then some of it has been like independent living, right? Finding a home, being able to stay in that home, and a part of the funds that the state gives you, you pay for a room in that home, and you get a job, but you have a lot of requirements, a ton. That you have to do, and you have to do it timely. Otherwise, you don't get your check. And so the things that you may have established for yourself, sometimes the bottom can fall out at any point in time if there's an obstacle. So those things are going to be things we could talk about on another podcast, but it just gives a little blanket of what Carrie would ultimately at 18 be up against. So Carrie, I'm gonna ask you, when you hit 18, what happened? Where were you? How did you navigate? And then I would love to hear, what was that point that you said, I want to share my story. I want to do more.
Yeah. So this is where it gets messy, in that, and I think my story is often not told.
Mm.
So because I was adopted, I was not considered as aged out because I did not go back into the foster care system.
Mm.
And what had happened in my adoptive family, the abuse that had happened that I reported to my adoptive parents went ignored. It was questioned. I was called a liar. And I was afraid. I was thinking in my mind, oh my gosh, I have a family. At least I'm not jumping from home to home. I get to stay in the same school. So it's worth it to me to live with some of these other things that were going on than to tell a teacher and potentially have to go to a new school district and leave all my friends who were my family. And so because I stayed quiet and I didn't tell anyone outside of our family unit about the abuse, technically, from the outside perspective, I was a saved child who had been adopted, who was in a family that loved me.
Mm-hmm.
That means I didn't qualify for any of the same supports for college. I didn't qualify for financial supports. So when I turned 18, I felt that sense of freedom. Like, I'm getting out of this prison that is, you know, being attached to this family. And I now get to go make my own life. And that's so exciting. But I was terrified and I didn't know how I was going to do it. And if I did not have the support of my best friend's family, I would have probably been working at Panera right now, making minimum wage, maybe having figured out how to get to a community college, but would not have had the experience of going out of state and getting a 4-year degree and having the healing that came from removing myself from that environment and being able to start to establish who Carrie was away from the guilt that I felt that I needed to protect my adoptive family and not share about the abuse that had happened, that I should just be grateful to have had a family.
That's really crucial. I want to stop just right there. Because I think that's a pivotal point that I do want people to hear, is like, I somewhat can relate to you, Carrie, and I say this just to help support your story, is that when I was adopted, I technically had several failed adoptions. I was formally adopted once. I almost was adopted two other times. One time I was in a home and I suffered sexual abuse in that home, didn't say anything, because where I'm going to go next? Because if this was like this, where's the next place?
Yeah.
Is it going to be worse?
Yeah.
You know, so it was kind of, I understand, I can relate, if you will, to some of that, of understanding that sometimes the hell you're in is better than the hell you don't know.
Yeah.
And
The
that,
familiar better is
yes.
better than the unfamiliar.
Yes. And it wasn't easy to sit in, but at least I know it. I understand what that is, if you will, in terms of what to expect. And so I'm going to protect myself as best that I can and try to endure until I just can't endure anymore. Right. And so, or until something else comes in and I can jump ship and do the next thing or go to the next thing. So it was a survival mode, but I want people to hear the fact that she said she was adopted. Carrie was adopted in a family. And so for her, the aging out, there wasn't all the services and all the availabilities there. And so essentially she was like a part of a silent group of kids in foster care that go unnoticed, and everybody just says, oh, they're fine, they're good, that's successful, we did good. And I have heard the system, once a kid is adopted, we're successful.
Yeah.
Are we? Because I was adopted, and when I was my first adoption that was formally made, it was not a successful adoption. It was a lot. It was a woman who wasn't equipped with trauma. I didn't understand my own trauma. And we survived each other, you know? And so I think that neither one of us had tools to even be successful in what was supposed to be something great. Right. And so, and then that family had its own challenges too. So you really are not saving a kid from one home. You're just putting them in another dysfunctional home. Their right. dysfunctions just look a little different than their family of origin. Right. And I don't know why we continue as a system to think that we can save a kid from putting them in from one home to another home, thinking that everything is going to be great. No, families in general need support. You know, and so when you're taking a child from the family of origin that have had issues and challenges, you have to make sure that you're giving that new family enough information, education, support, and being able to monitor even years later of offering some type of support or surveillance, if you will. I hate to say it, but like somebody being able to come in and check in, how are you doing, a visit or something, to be able to stay connected in a way to that family. And maybe you got to do it from the community, right? From the churches, or, you know, just different things that are in the YMCAs, right? Getting those places involved, so it's not so formal, like not a CPS, but it's more of a community involvement, if you will, right? That are natural places in the community.
Yeah. Reinvigorating again, that it takes a village to raise a child. And
yes.
And what you just described is so accurate, that I felt as if the system washed their hands of my case, and it was case closed. You have now gotten your happy ending and an adoption, and we're on to the next child. And if they would have come back even just within to do a 2-year checkup, it was within 2 years that my parents were getting divorced, and that I had been sexually abused by a sibling, that the drug addiction was happening throughout our home. If they would have just done a 2-year checkup, I think I would have probably been back in foster care. And it's hard because I wonder a lot about that. And it's hard because I was sexually abused in my biological family. And I reported to a preschool teacher, and I was told, good job, you did the right thing. We're now removing you from the situation, and you're going to be safe. And then I'm put into a home where I'm sexually abused again by a sibling. And I tell my parents, and they gaslight me. They tell me, You're getting it mixed up with the last time. You're having a nightmare. You're confused. So and so would never do that. And so, as a little girl trying to figure out these messages, to me, I had done what I was supposed to do. And if what they were telling me was this, then I just thought, okay, that, yeah, I must be confused. I must be having a nightmare. I must be, you know, I must be totally wrong. And so I should just let it go. And that's when that mindset came into my head that I should just be grateful and do what I can to earn my place in this family, to earn their love. And that started a really talking about, you know, the impacts of childhood trauma in our adult life.
Yeah, no, for sure. I've had those challenges as well, of like maneuvering through some of the messages in your childhood of, yeah, you know, I didn't tell for a long time. So I was actually penalized. Oh, we're not going to, you took so long to say something. Well, how am I supposed to say something when really there was no place for me to go anyway as a child, right? Like I was completely told, you're a teenager, nobody wants you. So for me, it was, I have to preserve a space or a place somewhere, you know, so at the end of the day, I'm going to just bite the bullet and deal with what I have right now. And so anyway, so those things mark you, but wow, your story is just so powerful. I'm just processing still. But I think that, you know, people need to understand when they work in this, you can't, I've said this before on some of my podcasts, you have to feel the work. Mm-hmm. And so I think that what makes me different even as a social worker is that I try to humanize every client that mm-hmm. I have and really look at not just giving you what the system teaches you, mm-hmm. not just the policies, but I try to give you experience, right? Like I really do care, because I do. And it's hard because I actually suffer the loss too when they have to move on and do mm-hmm. things. But I want them to know that I came across this one lady. If they remember my name, yeah. And most of the time they do, but I want them yeah. to really feel like I know that she truly cared about me, and I will go to the ends of the earth to advocate, to help that kid feel heard, to make sure that their concerns, you know, are heard and that they feel like they have power in their own voice, you know, and that we need to take it real, because that's a message too. Right. Mm-hmm. And so, and I don't want them to hear, you're just the foster child, because here's another message. And this is where we get wrong. And this is another thing that we have to help the system move through in order for kids to feel more than a foster child, is that because you've gone through a hard time, because you've gone through and your family doesn't want you, or, and really that's not even the case. It's your family was unfit and you were taken from your family. Mm-hmm. And so when you're removed from your home, and then you go through one home to the next home, to the next mm-hmm. home, if that's your story, or you're in a home, right? And you stay there for a while and everybody, she's good, they're good, he's good, whatever. We have to do better, I would say, as a system, to not allow others who are sent to help or to be a solution to be able to leverage our lack or our circumstance to make it seem that we're crazy, we're the liars, that we're incapable of knowing what we need or being able to, or being credible. That's a great word, mm-hmm. or disqualifying us mm-hmm. that we're, because I often, when you're sharing your story, I'm thinking my story, I'm thinking about stories that I've heard, and it always ties back to, when you're going through the system or you're going through your experience and your story, it's often that society, people who work in the system, outside the system, a lot of people want to shh you. Shh. That didn't happen. Mm-mm. Because it then reveals to the greater community, dang, the system is not good. The system is failing these kids, because mm-hmm. that's when you get highlight reels of kids that have died in residentials or kids that have died in foster homes, you know. Oh, we thought it was good. Oh, these people took in all these kids and they're such great Samaritans. They're awesome folks. And they are. There are some really great people, but again, it's individualized and stop looking at this grander, this is the solution, so that's the success. And then also looking at each person, each kid, and understanding what's their story and how can you cultivate their story by helping them be resilient, giving them tools, giving them access to community resources, right? Being that person that is an encourager, you know, things of that nature. All of those pieces, I want us to look grander as a system of how we can create individualized experiences in a way, which means that we have to have people that care and not just do the job. Yeah, we have to have people who kind of go in and own. I do think there needs to be a level of ownership of your clients in a way of saying, I'm going to own my role in their life. Not that I own Carrie. My client is Carrie and I own her. No, it's an ownership of, I'm going to own the fact that the work that I do with Carrie and her family, those around her, I'm going to own what I'm doing and how she's experiencing me and how we navigate this to make sure that she's getting what she needs so that she can ultimately achieve the success that she desires for her life.
Yes. And you know, I know social workers are under a lot of pressure and they get a lot of negative feedback and critique. But if you're a social worker, if you're a child welfare professional, the work that you are doing is legacy work. It is work that you will lay on your deathbed and be proud of. It is work that will see fruit and harvest for generations to come. And I can't think of a more purposeful career in life than that, to fight for a child's safety, to fight for a child's right to experience love and belonging. That is legacy work. And I think where we go wrong is when we do just start to see it as a job from any perspective. And in the way that external stakeholders look at social workers and look at it as a job, it's not just a job. It's so much more than that. And it is, it's emotional, it's taxing, it is, it's hard work, but it's so meaningful. And the other thing you said made me think that we want easy solutions. We want simple fixes. And so in America, we have set up this system where, okay, the family is struggling. So what do we do to keep the child safe? Well, let's just pluck the child from that situation and put them into foster care. And that's going to solve everything. And then when they're in foster care, we're going to take them and put them into adoptions, and that's going to make everything better. And they're now going to be safe and everything's going to be cherries and roses. That whole idea is the same idea in relationship therapy of, I'm just going to move from this relationship that wasn't working into this relationship. But then when I'm in this relationship, there's some of the same patterns, some of the same cycles repeating because we haven't actually gotten to the root of it. And at the root of this system is trauma. And if we don't actually talk about trauma and we don't help people to heal and deal with their trauma, we keep repeating these cycles in different houses and different family systems. And that is what a lot of adoptees are now screaming. They're screaming, adoption is trauma. My trauma that I've experienced prior to this doesn't go away when I come into this family unit and we sign adoption papers. And on the flip side of it, what I've seen is if that adoptive family has trauma that's pre-existing to that child, and then you have
it clashes.
It's trauma and trauma war.
Yes.
It's
a trauma bond.
Yeah.
Too. It can become a toxic trauma bond. And that also is telling, because I've experienced too, where you have that. And then relationships that I saw were the very same. It was much of a mirror of what I was going through. And it took a lot of cleansing experience to get out of that cycle, right? Yeah. A lot of internal.
We talk about physical safety as such a priority for when we're thinking of qualifying a family to adopt. we really need to look at emotional safety. Has this adoptive family done the emotional work to be able to carry the trauma of the child that's now coming into their family unit? Because there inevitably will be people who are getting triggered for different reasons.
Mm-hmm. Hold on, we're gonna stop there.
Okay. And I think when we are looking at adoptive families and we're thinking about how do we qualify a family to adopt, we focus a lot on the physical safety and whether or not that placement is going to benefit the child in that way. But we have to focus more on emotional safety and making sure that this family is equipped to be able to carry the trauma that is inevitably going to come with the child that enters their family unit, but also making sure that they have had the tools to heal from any of their existing trauma that has happened to them or in their family unit. And if we did that, I think we would see a lot more successful adoption outcomes.
Yeah, I would agree. When I was a licensing specialist, I did that for like 2 years. And I was always looking at like our process. And I was like, man, how do we really know? Like when you go out to their home, they want you to see the best, because you know what? There's a deep need for a lot of foster parents to help, but it's a deeper need sometimes to, they want a child, you know. Oftentimes there are a number of couples that come together or individuals that come together, and they want a kid. They want their own kid. And I always question that. I don't think it's a bad thing, because I understand, hey, you know what, if we can't have one naturally, let's go and see if we impact another person's life. But I think what you were saying is like that emotional safety is, sometimes I feel like people jump into it way too soon. It's like, you have to resolve you not being able to have a child, because you have to be completely emotionally available, because this kid is not your own. This kid is coming to you with their own story, their own baggage that you need to be safe enough and healthy enough to receive and not have your opinion on it. Well, I'm giving you a home. I'm giving you everything that you want and you need. And I just don't understand why you're acting like this. You know, I don't understand why I can't keep, you know what? I don't want them. They're not a good fit. They're move on. Whoa. You really wanted to impact a child. You have to accept them for where they are. The kid is not going to, I mean, even my own kids, I'm a mom of 2 natural babies, and it is a challenge just being my own blood and energy and genes and everything like that, because my children have their individuals. They are not me. They are not their dad. We are a part of them, but I even have to create an emotional safe place to receive my kids and allow them to have these times where, guess what? They not listen to everything I say. They're not perfect kids, you know, and they're also experiencing the world. Right? So they're having other experiences that they're bringing home that we have to tackle and support and encourage and be a safe place with. But I can guarantee you, Carrie, to your point, if I didn't do my work in my 20s, there was no way that I would feel any level of success in being the mom that I am now. And I'm still learning to be that, right? But it's not clouded by these untapped wounds, you know, these untapped healing or things, voids that I didn't uncover, right? There are things where I've healed and I have space in me. I'm not cluttered inside, internally, emotionally, physically, all that stuff. So that is so important when you come into it. We need foster parents. We need adoptive parents. So me and Carrie are not saying that's a bad idea. We're not saying that. Please hear us. But we are saying, based on our experiences, what we've observed, the work that we have done, we have seen some of these pieces that I think that we need to add to the experience to make it more comprehensive in what we're saying the system needs to go forward in to support those who have experienced foster care, because we don't want kids who are in foster care to feel like that is it. And then we're adding to the trauma that they already have on top of giving them a family who has their own trauma that then goes in. And then we've just kind of compiled this thing. And then we think nothing of it because we put them in the homes and we say, you're good. Right. So yeah, I felt that.
Adoption is a beautiful thing. And I think we're saying is it will be one of the most humbling things that you go through. And you cannot go in it with ego. You cannot go in it with, I am having this child step into the box that I've built for what I want my children to be.
Say that again. I need you to,
you
that is
cannot
so
have a
critical.
Child step into a box and think this is who I want this child to be. That's now my child. They are a person separate who is coming with their own family story and history that is impacting the way they'll come into your family. And you have to be able to accept that and see that and help them process that. That is such a huge piece of being an adoptive parent.
That's so good. So we've said a lot, but we got to get to this point. Cause man, this is good. This is good. So I hope everybody is hearing us and knowing like we support adoptive families, we support foster families. We are happy to be voices in this system and professionals that can come and see things from a unique view from our experiences personally and professionally. And so we are giving insight, but we're also offering a grander view of what we already have to say how we need to enhance that. Okay. So I need people to hear that as we are creating solutions, you have two professionals that are really advocating to say, we need to have more tools that we give our people who are coming in to help. And we need to have a higher standard as well and say, hey, we don't want just your home. We don't want just you as people showing up to parent. We want people who are willing to do the work, not just getting background checks, not just completing reports that tell us a little bit about who you are, but we want you to be ready for emotional healing from whatever you came with and being a space and being open outside of what your expectations is to be really open to helping a child be who they are. And it will be seasons where it'll be extremely difficult, right? Mm-hmm. But just because they're the foster child, we don't want them to also be limited and silenced and disqualified from having voice either. So that brings me to, so Carrie, you went through this very unique experience coming from foster care and experiencing what the system said was success for a foster child, which is ultimately adoption, right? Or sometimes that success is reunification, and you had that as well. But those things were not successful for you. So at what point can you share with us, since we've said all these things, so like everybody's like, okay, so if that's not solution, that's not solution. So then, hey, how did you get where you are? So really, at what point did it click for you? And when did you start reaching for your success and also feeling comfortable to share your story and then your purpose behind that?
I think that it's still a work in progress and that I am redefining success in this era of my life, because for so long, I thought that if I could just level up another accolade, another award, another achievement by the eyes of everyone else, that I was doing what I needed to do in life to be successful. And for the first time in my life, I'm in this season, I'm in this period of this era that success can really be getting up every day and being a kind person and going out into the world and seeing, I'm a human, you're a human. We're all trying to navigate this life that throws us obstacles, and let's help each other through that race. Mm. That is success. Mm-hmm. And for so long, it's like, oh no, you're successful because you're one of the 3% that graduated college. You're successful because you have a job and you're doing this and you're doing that. And we're so quick to label. And that's what we need to get rid of, is the labels. Mm-hmm. Stop labeling one another. Stop labeling and needing to put all of these, you know, foster kid or whatever. It's all about humans and the human experience. And the more that we can get back to that purified water is when we're doing something right. That's success.
So Carrie, how do we, this is a good question. This is a good question. How do we, and I'm including me, because a part of what I do is to help. Let me backtrack a little bit. I felt it when you said get the accolade, because when I started telling my story, I did it and it was very impactful because of how it was received from the youth. Then of course the adults started asking me to speak, and I almost felt like it was to show, I kind of said this before we were recording, but it was almost like pity, right? And so it's like, and other people to see these poor kids, they really need you to help. I became your marketing ad, which is not necessarily a problem, but then what does that do for me? Right. And I, and granted, some of these places I was paid for my story. So I appreciate that you contributed to what I wanted to do next in my life, right? Or help me pay the rent. It might be simple as that. But in the same token, I feel though sometimes I have even said, how do we move, or how can I get kids who have grown up in the foster care system? Let's improve that number from 3% to 4%. Let's get that number increased, because you shouldn't be a number. Like, we shouldn't be this, we represent such the negative in society. And it's like, I want us to represent the positive. So as professionals who are, if you're listening to this podcast, I am very confident these are people who want to know. They want answers. They want to be a part of the solution. And they want to be a part of the change that we want to see. So what is it that you think that we should do in how we think about this? How do we help? Instead of labeling, how then do we help kids that we work with? How do we help our frontline workers, those that we oversee? How do we help them to understand how to really help kids find their success and encourage their success without always saying, well, you're a foster care and this is all the odds against you. And so now we're also putting the pressure on you because here's all the negatives that are against you. How do we do that? Cause that is complex.
I think it begins with proximity and in relationship. Mm. And it's easy in the system for things to become so transactional that you don't leave space, you don't have time for relationship. And for those of us who are moving through the foster care system, I think many of us would say we don't feel heard, we don't feel seen. And if we could just get to a place where we make sure every young person feels heard, feels seen, knows they're valued, that's how I think we unlock this secret ingredient that we're all searching for. That's like, how do we help them to be successful? Because that's at the heart of it. Mm-hmm. And when people seek to be seen, seek to be heard, seek to be loved, they do that in many different ways. And if they're not getting that, the ways that they seek it are often hurtful to them and to others.
Mm-hmm. Whatever the government agency calls itself, I would say, what does that look like? I have a lot of paperwork. I got to go to court. I'm being pulled. There's crisis. I got one kid has ran away. So I got to go do A, B, C, and D. I got a foster parent who has a crisis in her house. So I'm got to go see that kid. But I also have to prepare all of these reports that are due by the end of the week. How do I help the kids that I really work for feel valued, feel seen? How do I really help foster that relationship when I have so little time to do so? Because mm-hmm. that's the question we're going to get.
Mm-hmm. And if you are in that position, it should not be falling on you. All of that is overwhelming. And that's where we don't leave space for there to really be that relationship. And so this is where it's critical for our communities to step up and surround these young people, surround these caseworkers, so that we're hitting that child with so many points of support that it doesn't fall on one person. And that's the same with any parent. Parents need support. And that's why it's critical to have neighbors, to have family members who can watch the kids so you can get a breather and go do a load of laundry. It's the same
thing.
Come
on, Carrie.
Caseworkers. They need that too. They need to feel like they, not every piece of this child is falling on them alone.
Yes.
And that's where we need to invigorate our churches. Step up, churches, mentor that child, hang out with that child, be a friend to that child, get to know them. Communities, just all of that, I think is critical to where are we going to see a significant shift?
I love that. So we're not saying that the onus is really on that worker, but how can that worker really navigate and be a bridge, a facilitator to helping community and not people who are just paid? I think that's another thing I want to hit on just real quick of, you know, we don't have to pay people. We shouldn't have to pay people just to be in a child's life. Children know that. As a youth, you know who is doing it because they're getting paid to do it, and versus the people who are in it because, hey, I'm in it. And I know it's a big thing. A lot of people argue against that. I'm not saying, hey, I get paid to do what I do. I believe that it's a privilege and an honor to be able to do so that I actually get paid to do what I want to do that I would have did for free anyway, because I've done some of my work for free. Okay. But I definitely count it a blessing to be able to make a living doing what I do, but I also assist in gathering others who to kids, to the people that I work with that are not necessarily being paid to do what they do, so that the kids do feel that there are people out there in society that do care about your well-being, and we ain't got to pay them to get them in to do that. Right.
Absolutely.
So I think what you're saying is very key and something that we need to advocate. I think even from the top of helping initiatives to move forward. I think we've talked about this before of like child welfare, not just being a service that is offered by the government, but really being like a public health thing of like really pushing and helping and saying, hey, this is our societal issue. We own this issue because there are people in our communities that don't have what they need and they're hurting. How do we as American people, as an American society, come together as a unified, just like we come together when there's tragedies, natural disasters, and people are giving and yeah, everybody isn't gonna want to support foster care. I get it. Cause people have their own loves, interests, hearts that, hey, fine with me. But I think that if our government were to do more from a public health standpoint of saying mental health is a part of that, our community health is a part of that, and how do we foster in all communities, rural, urban, suburban, everywhere, right? Spaces and places to where people, families can thrive.
Yeah. And the system is built in such a transactional way that that's why you have a lot of advocates saying abolish the system, because it's so transactional. We're never going to get to the heart of what families need, and that we really need to remove all these government parties and get back to we're people. And I see this family needs help right now, and I want to help them, because if I were in that situation, that's also what I would want. But now that we have this behemoth of a child welfare system, there's so many labels. There's divided parties where you're a bad parent, I'm a good parent, I'm going to come in and rescue your kid because you've done a bad job, and now you're pretty much written off. And then you have the kid who's labeled as, you know, foster kid. And there's so many things that come with that, that again, there's such a narrative shift that has to occur for us to really be able to start to make a dent in how large the system is.
And I think a part of that is some of the work that we're doing individually, me and myself, me, you, and others who are championing like this. We're not offering services, but we're offering mindset shifts.
Yeah.
Like you said, changing the narrative, because I think if we can't change that, then no matter what we do in terms of services, it's not going to do anything, right? And it to your point, that transactional piece, and that's right. So like a lot of people talk about like, oh, well, parents, they come in, and a lot of parents, and I've seen them, parents who have had their children take away, sometimes they know how to run that system, play that system to get what they need, because they know that is what the system that's what they're saying. That's the message. What do you need? We'll give you, we can offer you A, B, C, and D. Then they come, they take, and then they're mad because then it's like, well, hey, then they're not ready to take their kids sometimes. But it's like, who fostered a relationship with that parent and really exactly. saw that parent and what they were going through? So exactly. you have people who have backdoor drug addictions and you don't know it because nobody has a relationship with them.
Yeah. And it's and those parents are in survival mode mm-hmm. and they have their own stories. And if we sat down and we said, what happened to you? Mm-hmm. What are you experiencing internally? How do we help you work through that so that you can be the parent that I know you want to be?
Mm-hmm. That's so real. So I think that, we have kids that are placed in the foster care system, nothing that they've done, at all, but they're placed, they grow up, they manage, they endure, they survive. Right. And I've said this before as a quote, like, kids should not have to survive. It says a lot when you have to survive mm-hmm. the foster care system. Mm-hmm. The fact that you just have to survive and it's applauded. I have always struggled and to the point of being more than a foster kid. I have for so long struggled. You're such a survivor. I don't know how I feel about that. Why is that celebrated? I don't really want to be a survivor. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest. When I hit 30, I said, you know what? I still hadn't reached this place of still getting out of that box of foster care. Mm. And I'm like, man, I am a full grown woman. I have degrees. I'm married. I got a child. I got all these various things. And I'm like, I still feel like this foster care label runs over me. And I think it's because so many people throughout my time, even impacting community, impacting kids in foster care, all that work, I felt like wasn't enough because so many people celebrated the fact that I survived it. Mm-hmm. Why are we celebrating? I survived it. Mm-hmm. So I think feeling better, now I'm in a better place, I will say, is that I think that what happens, the shift that I've seen personally, is that when I put my story somewhat away, I wasn't talking about it as much. And I focused a lot of my attention on Cherish and my growth and development as a professional. I think that I shifted how people saw me. And so I don't get the celebration, my accolades and my accomplishments become more Cherish versus Cherish the foster kid. Mm. That's sad because I still want to own. And so it's almost been a battle of picking your story as a foster child and then also being the woman that you've become or the young man that you've become or the person you've become, whatever. Mm-hmm. Not whatever, but the person that you've become and this experience that you had as a child that you don't really want to deny or neglect, but mm-hmm. at the same time that you don't want that to be everything. You want it to just be a part, not a sum of all parts. And so we're asking, as people who have experienced that in our life, when we grow up, let us grow up. Let us have something more than just the foster kid. And if we choose to tell our story, hear our story, do not have pity on us because that is not what we want. We want you to see that, yes, we survived these circumstances and we made something out of it. And we want you to celebrate us in our growth. And then also where we want to go and how I think if anything, when you see a child open up and has the courage mm-hmm. to share what they have gone through, because those are very, there's a lot of shame connected to it, guilt. There's a lot of tragedy, a lot of trauma, mm-hmm. a lot that goes in that, that's packed into that thing. So when people are sharing, what, Carrie, would you encourage people to do? How do we, as leaders, child welfare leaders who are listening, how do we do better at receiving and supporting versus labeling and just seeing someone as the foster kid?
Mm. Everyone should read A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle.
Love it. Resources.
Yeah, which I think just reminds us again of the human experience and some of those core wants and desires and that we want to be known for certain things, but then we don't because there's sometimes shame associated with that. And so I guess I would say to the child welfare professional, as much as you can, to look at the clients that you work with, the young people that you work with, the families that you work with. It's, I'm seeing you, I'm seeing you as cherish. Yes, you went through this and you went through that. And those were waves and they come and they go and you continue to move through life and evolve. And I can see all of you and I can appreciate that experience and how similar it may or may not be to my own when I'm not so focused on naming what that is, when I'm not so focused on attaching labels to it. And it sounds, when I speak it, I feel like it sounds so 10,000 foot and like philosophical, but, and when you really get down to it, it's so simple.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, we as humans, we have this desire to make sense of everything. And sometimes we just have to let it be what it was and not dwell too much on defining mm-hmm. it as positive, as negative. It just, it was.
And I would encourage people to, when we introduce people, if we ask for those to be invited to speak to others to help, because I do know that the intention is to invite so that more people can understand the plight. I get that. I really do think, I don't think that people are, hey, come have the kid come so I can exploit you. I don't think that is really the reason or the intention. However, I think that sometimes it can come off that way, right? Because there really isn't anything else that is offered to someone who speaks their story, except for keep coming and sharing, keep coming and sharing. And that can be traumatic too, depending on where that person really is. And yes, they want to share their story because they as well want to make impact and change the system. But I would like to also encourage people to understand that when you are inviting people to come and speak, that you want to make sure that also you're introducing them as a person and not yeah. because they were an alumni. Yeah. A part of it is, hey, they have such a strong story. I want to share because they're domestic violence survivors. There are people who have, you know, survived their own abuse and addictions that go and get paid thousands and thousands of dollars yeah. to speak. And what you don't hear firsthand is the fact they overcome. They're saying, yeah. hey, here's so on and so forth. And they have done phenomenal things in the community and blah, blah, blah. And they also have had their challenges with this drug or this issue or this circumstance. And I want you to hear from them how they overcame.
Yeah.
That is such a different story than that.
Yeah. So two things. One, that's why so many young people leave the system and they don't talk about their foster care experience because they've been labeled foster kid for years and years and years. And so then they leave the system and many of them will not go on to share their stories. And that's why there's such a misunderstanding of the plight of foster care because there was shame associated with it. So we don't want there to be shame because there shouldn't be, it wasn't their mm-hmm. fault, but we also don't want it to be the sole thing that they're recognized and noticed for, and that they feel like they have to keep relevant for them to be seen and heard.
Mm-hmm.
And then I want to share that when I got my foster care file and I started to process all of these things at 4 years old, the psychiatrist said I was already at risk of PTSD. I have, you know, one of those labels is that I am working through complex PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And so reading through this file, there's so many labels on me, on my parents, on the situation at hand. And it's overwhelming going through police reports, psych evaluations, doctors, court documents, all of these things. And then there was one piece of paper typed up, Word document, two paragraphs. And it talked about Carrie. It said, Carrie loves to read. Carrie loves to dance. Carrie loves to play with her sister, Nicole. Nicole's her best friend. That is my favorite page. And that file. And it reminds me that I am human before I am all of these things that have happened to me and all of these labels that have been attached to me. That in the inside, the things that bring me joy are those things that just I get to experience and be present in without worrying about the past and everything that's happened or fretting about what's going to happen in the future. And yeah. I don't know. I that something about this conversation just reminded me of that.
That's beautiful. And this is a special edition. I had to take a break for a little bit. Life got a little crazy, got some promotions at work. So you're actually my first interview for a couple of months, actually. So I'm cool with the fact that this is a little bit longer. And we're having one of my favorite conversations because I've been waiting to have this conversation for such a long time, because I really do believe that this is a message that people need to hear. They're going to want to hear because they want to help, right? They want to be changed. They want to be a part of that change in moving us forward. So I'm going to wrap up. I really appreciate Kerry coming on. I think it is so great to be able to join forces and just be in your presence, be in each other's presence, of knowing that we're two people who have overcome circumstances in our lives and chosen to literally allow that to be purpose for us and impacting much more than us, that it's not about us, but it's about really helping others. And that is, to me, that's that legacy work, right? That's that bigger picture that your life represents, right? And that's what we're trying to say is too, more than foster kids. What's inside kids who have endured foster care or anything else for that matter, there's purpose. And it's about helping we as people in society, no matter if you're a social worker in child welfare, and for this, you're in child welfare, but it's really about unlocking the purpose that's already sitting inside that person. And a part of that sometimes is trials, tribulations, and storms in order to refine the experiences that one has. That's a part of life. That is not a foster care experience. That is a life experience.
Yeah.
And so that's something I want to drive home to, as I found when I went to college, is that, hey, my experience is not just Cherish is here over here somewhere tucked away, and she's just this bad person. Everything just happens to her. I recognize that being in so many people and hearing so many different stories, I just so happened to be placed in foster care, but others had parents and grew up in those homes who had drug addictions, who experienced some of the similar things and really went through some really tough stuff, and they just weren't in foster care. I just so happened to be in foster care. And sometimes I saw that as a good thing, because some of the things that people had to actually sit and endure, even in their own homes, was really hard. But it really helped me to really understand that our experience in that part of our life isn't just a foster care experience. It's not, don't isolate it.
Yes.
It is a life experience.
Yes.
So we're just a part of a bigger population of people in the community that just got taken out of the community of experienced life. This is just a part of our life. And so I think that's really the message, is we are more than just the foster care experience. We have a life experience, a human experience that we are growing from, growing through, and becoming. It's all a part of becoming who we are destined to be. Mm-hmm. And that journey has never arrived. Mm-hmm. That is lifelong. So even if we're living until we're 99, that is still this evolution of our life, mm-hmm. right? And so the beautiful part is we get to experience so many things that help to enrich who we are as individuals. Mm-hmm. And so if you can help others to see us for us, for who we have shown up to you as, that's the message that we want to be received as such. We want to be received as Kerry Hope. We want to be received as Cherish Fields, or whoever that other person is that you get to encounter who has such a sacred story that they want to share with others to empower them so that they can advocate and they can be a part of that change. That's their legacy that they're revealing to you. That is what they're sharing with you. That is that power that they're extending to have it more of a human experience so other people can see I'm human too. That's that relatability. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we really want to tap into. Not just that, oh, poor thing, she went through that, he went through that. Oh man, that really sucks.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's, wow, you are so strong And we receive that and so happy for everything that you're doing and you're accomplishing. And yeah, I would love to learn from you. Like, we want to be able to teach you something, extend something, help with something greater, right? For sure. So Carrie, thank you again. I do want to thank her for her time, but also support the fact that she gave a good book. I had this book, read this book in my 20s, my early 20s. New Earth by Eckhart Tolle is such a great book. It's a book, even if you want to purchase it as a graduation gift for one of your youth, I think that would be awesome. Graduation from high school, graduation from college, tools. Honestly, healing for me was books. So I always say, if you find a good book, make sure that you give it to your youth, give them, bless them with a subscription to Audible. Self-development and personal development is huge as people, yes, right? And so anything we could do to foster that is huge. So again, I want to thank everybody for their time. You know what? This has been Child Welfare Leaders. Thank you for Carrie, your presence and helping us with this special episode. Hope to have you again. And if people want to reach out to you and support your podcast and things you're doing, can you give us a quick 30-second? And I'm going to also make sure her social media goes on the description. So go ahead, Carrie.
Thank you. Yeah. You can find me on Instagram at Carrie Hope Richmond. Please follow Unbelievably Resilient. Our handle is at ur.resilient on Instagram. And then our website is www.ur-resilient.org.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, everyone. Continue to hit that subscribe button. Watch us. I know it's been a minute, but stay with me. I'm still coming with new episodes at least once a month. All right. Take care.
Thank you, Cherish.